1931. Clifford D. Simic hunkered down to pen a story for the burgeoning pulp magazine market. Why not? Everyone else was doing it. There were hundreds of titles out there, touting everything from rollicking high adventure, westerns, romance, crime, and science fiction. Simic tore through pages in longhand, and his young wife, Kay, took those pages and typed them into a manuscript. Who knows how many stories he struggled over before hitting on this one, but The World of the Red Sun would be the first to make it into the pages of Wonder Stories. Wow, Simic was finally in print, and strangely, or maybe not so strangely, the Midwest would feature prominently in his otherworldly stories and novels over the next 50-odd years. He would come to be known as the pastoral science fiction writer. Over and over again, his ordinary heroes, common folk really, would walk out of their front doors into worlds of wonder. Time paradoxes, first contacts with alien races, encounters with immortals. But they always took the Midwest with them in their no-nonsense humanity and rootedness to the natural world. Just like the man Simic himself, who once said of his fiction, "This, then, by my own evaluation, must stand as my small contribution to science fiction. It is, of course, only a very small fraction of the whole. My fellow writers have made many larger and more significant contributions." Even his modesty was purely Midwestern, because with over 100 short stories to his credit, more than 30 novels, 3 Hugo Awards, 1 Nebula Award, and designation by his peers as a grand master of science fiction, he stood as one of the greats in an age and in a field that fairly glittered with literary talent. Isaac Asimov, Arthur C. Clarke, Ray Bradbury, and Robert Heinlein. Simic followed his own star. He wrote in what he called a quiet manner, and his only hope was that in his stories of ordinary people faced with extraordinary situations, the reader would, he said, find some liking for them. If you do, they have justified their writing.
A few years ago, I realized with something of a shock that I was an expatriate writer. I had been born and raised in the southwestern corner of Wisconsin, a land of ancient hills and filled with a strange woodland beauty. All my life, I have used this piece of country as a background to many of my stories, and that in going back to it, I expect not what it actually is, but my idealized version of it. Now, I go back to it very seldom, for so long as I stay away from it, I can be secure in the fantasy of its existence, as I have constructed it in my mind. That's the way I want to keep it.
From a letter Simic wrote in 1971.
Yeah, he was born in Wisconsin. My dad was born in 1904, so he was growing up in the teens and 20s.
Ellen Simic is Cliff Simic's daughter.
He grew up on a farm with my grandmother and grandfather and his younger brother, Carson. The stories that I've always heard from both Dad and Uncle Carson were that it must have been a hardscrabble life, but it, to them, was an idyllic childhood. They talked about roaming around the countryside and hunting and fishing and getting into all sorts of boyish pranks and just having a great time. It was a very strong, fond memory for Dad, which is in part probably why that kind of rural countryside, I would guess, figures into his stories so often. I think he went to Patch Grove School, and I always understood that he got like a teaching certificate and maybe taught school for a year or two. But in about 1929, about the time he met my mom, he switched over to journalism and worked a series of jobs in small-town newspapers around the Midwest I think about maybe 15 years or so, maybe a little bit more than that, until they settled down in the Minneapolis area. He met my mom on a newspaper. The story goes, as I recall, Mom was writing some kind of column, and which she signed K. Her real name was Agnes, but her last name was Kishenberg, and everybody called her K. And Mom always said that they got married in the morning and he had to cover a baseball game in the afternoon. I think it was a solid relationship. At the beginning, Dad told me Mom would type the stories for him and help him out that way.
It was during the early years of knocking around between Midwestern small-town newspapers that Simic began to publish in the pulps. For science fiction fans, his first published story, The World of the Red Sun, has an interesting side note because it earned a critical reply from a junior high student who would one day rank among the big three of science fiction authors.
I can tell you a story about Isaac Asimov's feeling that he was influenced by Simic.
Ruth Berman is an award-winning poet and the author of the recent fantasy novel, Bradamont's Quest.
When Isaac Asimov was a teenage science fiction fan, he read a story by Simic that he thought was basically very good, but it had a lot of problems with it, things that didn't quite fit together. And he wrote a long, long letter about all the things that were wrong with the story. And to his amazement, he got a letter back from Simic. And Simic said, "Thank you so much for being so interested in my work as to put all this time and thought into it. And if you want to write a letter to me again about my work, please feel free to do so." And Isaac thought, "How wonderful, I will write another letter right away." And he sat down and reread the story, looking for more faults. And rereading the story, he discovered that everything he thought was a fault, something that didn't fit together, was a subtlety that he'd missed the first time round. So at that point, he came away with a great respect for Simic's writing and a great respect for Simic's way of handling fans.
Simic's success with The World of the Red Sun spurred him to produce another four stories in short order, all of them drawing on the current themes and swashbuckling atmosphere found in the pulps. David Wixon was a friend of Simic's.
If you know what the term potboiler means, that was what they were looking for in science fiction. They wanted ray guns shoot down the aliens, rocket ships blasting through space, and nothing beyond that. And Cliff tried his hand at that and was fairly decent at it, but he got bored with it. He thought there was a heck of a lot more to life and literature than that. And the thing about it was the pulps paid very, very little. I mean, literally, a lot of the pulp writers, they felt good if they got a half cent a word. Of course, money went a good deal further in those days, but even as late as the late 40s, people like Gordy Dixon, you know, were hacking these things out as fast as they could because they had to. Gordy, I remember, told me that a couple of times he had gone down to a blood bank and sold a pint of his blood to get eating money, you know, that kind of thing. There wasn't much money in science fiction, and particularly in pulps. And one of the key things about it, of course, is that all these guys who are writing this, they had no idea that those things might ever get reprinted. I mean, literally, they thought, write the story, it'll be printed, in 6 months, everyone will have forgotten about it. Yeah. And it wasn't until you got into the 50s that you started to have the anthologies and the collections coming out, where all of a sudden they could recycle older stories. And that made an immense amount of difference to the income of a lot of them. The story you got $20 for back in 1930, you know, all of a sudden you might be able to recycle that and get another $20 for doing nothing. It was a wonderful thing for them. But in the pulp era itself, before this stall took over, they had to essentially meet the requirements of the editors. Cliff did not come to science fiction from the technology end. Even in his very late years, often when I would come to visit him, I would find him sitting with this huge two-volume set of the works of Thoreau, and he would just sit there and he would be just paging through. He would just open it at random just to read a passage because he just loved the way it spoke and the ambience of the Thoreau's world. And his other favorite was Proust. And I think that was what made his work so different from the very early science fiction writers. You know, they were going in a different direction. He was looking for more meaning than just, you know, shoot the alien down. It was Campbell finally who saw something in what he was producing and started putting that together and publishing that, and that really let him expand his work.
John W. Campbell Jr., a name that looms large in the science fiction pantheon. He not only profoundly influenced Simic, the writer, but the direction of science fiction over his 34-year reign as editor of Astounding Science Fiction. He put to rest the pulp era and ushered in the Golden Age. From his first issue in 1937, he shaped many up-and-coming writers with his rigorous style of editing and his vision of an orderly universe.
Campbell was a very realistic kind of guy. He wanted more background for the stories. It was called Astounding. Eventually, the magazine became Analog, which was, I think, pretty well symbolic, if delayed, for the fact that he wanted it to be realistic enough that you could make a scientific background that made a certain amount of sense. And that was one of the things that he demanded from his writers. And that weeded out some of them. Others learned to adapt to that. But he was not hard-headed about that. He was willing to bend that rule a little bit, I think, if he got a good story out of it. Above all, he wanted a story that was logical, that everything followed. You know, he wasn't willing to overlook an inconsistency, an incongruity. Eventually, he and Cliff drifted apart. John would only go so far towards the idea of exploring the human element. You know, Cliff wanted to keep on going, and he did.
Simic described the break in a letter to a young writer in 1970.
I guess you could write a book about Campbell. He's a complicated and at times a very irritating sort of person. He has rigid ideas about what kind of stories he wants. He doesn't give a damn about the writing. The idea is the only thing that is important, and it has to fit in very closely with what he personally thinks is important. I think that even in the past, when he was buying my stuff, I had to do a rewrite job to fit his own personal specifications on at least half of what I sold him. Each time I sent him a story, he would respond with one of his famous 5-page, single-spaced letters, telling you what was wrong with it, or, if he liked it, he was taking it without change, would point out the excellence of your idea and how you handled it. The guy was irrepressible. Behind that calm, almost grim exterior, he bubbled with enthusiasm. The last time anything of mine was submitted to him, Bob, my agent, sent him a copy of one of my books for possible serialization. He sent the manuscript back to Bob and said no, then wrote me the usual 5-page letter taking the hide off me for writing such a story. I replied something in this wise: "You have every right reject my work for any reasons or for no reason at all, but I will be damned if you can reject it for the wrong reasons and get away with it." Since then, John and I have preserved a dignified silence toward one another. I have a hunch that much the same thing might have happened with some of the other writers. Still, for all of that, you have to admire and respect the man. He has done a lot for science fiction.
In 1939, Simic and his wife moved to Minnesota to the Twin Cities Metro, which would be home to them for the rest of their lives. Simic took a journalism job at the Minneapolis Star and would eventually become its city desk editor. Meantime, though, he had other irons in the fire, like rooting out and establishing friendships with the local cadre of science fiction, fantasy, and horror writers, people like Carl Jacoby, Oliver Sari, Donald Wandry, and Gordon R. Dixon.
When I first started writing fiction, Gordon Dixon lived here, and Red Boggs lived here, and Clifford Simak.
Though Ruth Berman came along several decades later, she still enjoyed the influence of her local literary forebears.
And I was very much aware of the fact that there were some local science fiction writers. I don't know why that should make such a difference, but it does. If you say there are science fiction writers in this town, it seems to be more possible to write science fiction. Logically, that shouldn't be so, but it was.
Patrick Coleman is the Minnesota Historical Society's book curator.
If for an artist of any kind, it's really important to associate with your peers and kind of help each other. This is really a phenomena in the science fiction world, and it's really a phenomena here in the Twin Cities. In the 1930s, there was a group called the Unholy Five. That included Simic. I think he was always the ringleader of these groups. And also somebody like Oliver Sarri. He was an inventor. And they came together for an interesting purpose. Basically, they wanted to better the art of science fiction as a genre. They also wanted to improve their own skills. And they did this in a delightfully snarky way. They made fun of the genre. They would get together and they would co-write stories that would be really stupid, but it would be making fun of other science fiction authors at the time. According to accounts of these, sometimes they all were laughing so hard they were rolling around on the floor. Simic's dog was a member of this group, and a prominent member of the group, because the dog wrote a column for a newsletter that they published. And this was a little bit later iteration of it. In November of 1940, the group met at Simic's house and created the Minneapolis Fantasy Society. And that was a really significant watershed in local science fiction publishing.
Like a who's who of science fiction, horror, fantasy.
The author now of some 80 books, Jack Koblis, was just starting out when he met Simic.
They got together and they helped, you know, market each other's works. But it's kind of like writers getting together and, hey, have you tried this publisher? I remember he was a quiet speaker. I mean, he had a kind of a soft voice, and yet he would say so much. Well, he and Carl Jacoby both worked for the Minneapolis paper, so they were both journalists. Well, I think that took a lot of his time. He didn't get to write as much as he would have. But when you think about it, I'm just thinking of my own book collection at home, and I could stack hardcovers one on top of each other. And he wrote quite a bit, actually.
I got a hold of a copy of Carlos Baker's biography on Hemingway and have been reading it as I can. I am a bit nonplussed to find that he wrote it in about the same manner as I do, in longhand to start with, and then typing and revising as he went along. As a matter of identity, I have no illusions that I am another Hemingway, far from it, but I am pleased to find that someone else, at some time, did put together words the way I find I have to. November 1, 1970.
Simac continued to plug away at his short fiction, but increasingly turned to the novel to explore themes of time travel, the existence of God, and the meaning of humanity. Two serialized stories from the 30s eventually made it into book format, Creator in 1946 and Cosmic Engineers in 1950. A few more novels emerged in the 50s, but from 1961 to the mid-80s, Simac wrote and published about a novel a year, while also meeting journalistic deadlines and pulling together nonfiction books on science for a young adult audience. With such an output, he left his readers undecided on what, to them, was his most memorable title.
I remember especially his Shadow Play, which was a story in which there are people who have a thing which lets them project what they're imagining, and they have imagined various characters who meet and talk, and one day one of them dies. And they wonder which character is going to be missing. But it turns out none of the characters are missing. The characters have come alive.
A story that he wrote in 1949 called Limiting Factor. The story basically revolves around humans in space, and they discover this planet that's entirely sheathed in metal. And the next planet over, around that sun, there's this huge, wonderful, beautiful city, and there's nobody there.
Simac's archives at the University of Minnesota reveal the creative process the author went through to refine his ideas and transform them into logical and saleable stories.
Let us use the basic idea, but revise it the extension of a time bubble into our world. To do a job of this sort, they have to, for some reason, get a small colony of the plants on the other side in the other world. So, that the village is isolated inside the bubble, which grows and grows. Things to be worked in early. 1. The girl and the industrialist. 2. The phone and the old bum. 3. The flowers. Never caught on. 4. The old-time pal.
But what is his best-known work? It's many. The collection of interconnected short stories known as City, published in 1952 and the recipient of the International Fantasy Award.
These are the stories that the dogs tell when the fires burn high and the wind is from the north. Then each family circle gathers at the hearthstone, and the pups sit quietly and listen. And when the story's done, they ask many questions. What is man? They'll ask. Or perhaps, what is a city? Or, what is a war? City, 1952.
Simak retired from the Minneapolis Star in 1976, eager to devote his retirement to his creative work. But Kay died in 1985, and around the same period, he himself was diagnosed with heart failure. The last few years, Simak was laid up with a leukemia that would eventually cause his death, but the time was productive in another way, because a new generation of writers discovered him and flocked to his home in Excelsior, Minnesota, to talk about books and writing, and watch sports. Andy Decker was one of those young fans and writers who made the pilgrimage.
He did give me some advice. He said, if I wanted to write something, go ahead and write it. Don't let anyone, including himself, tell me it's not a good idea, it'll never sell, it's been done because it may be the best thing you ever wrote. Don't let anyone else discourage you from trying something. Coming from him, that was a very valuable piece of advice, and I've always heeded that. And I actually ended up writing a few things just because I thought, well, I got the idea, I'll give it a shot. So, yes, we were talking about collecting books. And he had said that long ago he had gone through and gotten rid of a lot of things that he didn't figure he really needed anymore. He said the one thing he regretted getting rid of was his collection of Saturday Evening Posts. On our next visit, we had hit every store in town, and we had picked up 3 or 4 copies of old Saturday Evening Posts. We gave those to him. He was very pleased. Absolutely wonderful. He said it was the best magazine ever published. And after that, every time I would get a chance to get up there and see him, I would pick up at least one more copy. I think one of the last visits I had with him, he was in bed, and we were sitting there on chairs in his bedroom, and he was lighting up his pipe, which he wasn't supposed to do. But he said, doctor's not here, he'll never know about it. He's got his pipe going, he was smoking, and he pointed over to a little end table and said, you know, those Saturday Evening Posts over there, I may never get through all of them, but it's a comfort knowing anytime I want to, I can go over and pick one up and read it. One of the books he inscribed to me is inscribed to Andy, a man who knows where old Saturday Evening Posts are hidden. And that book will never leave my collection. No. That one's there forever.
Ellen Simak.
I was in my room, was in high school, reading Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land, and my dad poked his head in the door and said, you never read any of my books. So I quickly put down Heinlein and picked up one of my dad's books and read. And since then, I read a lot of the books, and he would share them while they were in manuscript form with us and ask for feedback. But, you know, we really didn't have much to say. I mean, we thought it was cool. We might say something here and there. But it was just fun to read your dad's manuscripts in process. And he would always have stacks of notebooks by his desk where he filled them with ideas he had for stories or characters. I picked him up at the airport after he'd won the Grand Master Award. And he was excited to show it to me. He had it in his carry-on, wrapped in his pajamas. So in the Minneapolis airport, he took it out and showed it to me. And I will say it's quite an impressive award. So we were very close. And he introduced me to a lot of things. He introduced me to the arts, to museums, to classical music, to, I think, a gentle intellectual way of life. So he was a great dad. I'm very lucky.
David Wickson.
He wanted to keep on writing, but a lot of the spirit went out of him when Kay died, and then he developed leukemia. He was still enjoying life, but he was really very much housebound. You know, I've never forgotten, a little while after Kay died, I remember Cliff and I were sitting one afternoon watching a ball game, and he got really quiet. And I could see that his eyes had turned away from the screen. You know, I just let him alone. And after a while, he turned to me and he said, you know, he said, I really look forward to being with you. He said, but I hope you won't mind if I say this. And I said, say what? And he said, I'm not going to mind when I go. I've got no reason to be here anymore except you and the kids. And he said, and you're all doing fine. And he said, I don't want you to feel sad for me. And I said, okay, do you mind if I feel sad for myself? And he said, that would be okay. A lot of what you see in that does well these days in science fiction is going back to ray guns and rockets and aliens. And people like rousing adventures. It's always been that way, though, in all of literature, whether you're talking about a Western or a spy story or whatever. People want a good, rousing adventure that gets your blood moving. And entertainment value is what it is. And entertainment is all about eliciting emotion from people. And emotion comes where you find it. Cliff did a very different kind of emotion. Cliff's stories were quiet, about some guy who is minding his own business, so, you know, meets an alien who's in trouble and just helps him just to be friendly, you know, that kind of stuff. And yet you come away from that feeling warm inside. Something like Shakespeare's Planet, for instance. These people were stranded on this planet where this strange phenomenon far out in space that they ended up calling the God Hour would occur periodically. But it was as if a being somewhere in space would direct its attention to where they were, and they could feel it. They could feel that being's presence. You know, and they referred to this as the God Hour. Way Station was very much personal with him. The protagonist was an old Civil War soldier who's been granted near immortality by the aliens. And that is all about Cliff's grandfather. And I think that Cliff felt that because it was so personal with him, that made it not a very good story. You know, everybody disagreed. Just everybody.
There were proud names that were the prouder now. But now, no more than names to echo down the ages. The Iron Brigade. The 5th New Hampshire. The 1st Minnesota. The 2nd Massachusetts. The 16th Maine. And there was Enoch Wallace. He still held the shattered musket. And there were blisters on his hands. His face was smudged with powder. His shoes were caked with dust and blood. He was still alive. Way Station, 1963.
This is Britt Ahmet for KFAI.
Mini Culture on KFAI is made possible by listeners like you and the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.